Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to cover a very, very important subject, in particular to men, but not just to men, because men hang around with women, and when men develop problems with their prostate, in particular prostate cancer, which is so prevalent these days, it severely impacts their entire family. So the book that we're going to talk about today is, I think, a very, very important book. I think that it's something that we want to make all men aware of because it focuses specifically on a naturopathic approach to prostate cancer. Today's guest is Dr. Gio Espinosa. He's my good colleague here in New York, and he's a very well-known naturopathic doctor who is one of America's foremost integrative urology specialists. He's published in peer-reviewed scientific journals related to integrative management of prostate conditions and urological disorders. He's been a medical contributor to Men's Journal Magazine, WebMD, and major medical textbooks. And he has an office in the belly of the beast, literally within a major academic center at New York University Langone Medical Center here in New York. It's a pioneering center. It's called the Integrative and Functional Urology Center, which is very cool because here they're taking both a high-tech approach and a natural approach, which is what's required for treatment of this. He is certainly well-positioned to tell us about a strategy for not just preventing prostate cancer, but dealing with prostate cancer should the need arise. So congratulations on the book. And by the way, the book is called, a little drum roll, please, Dr. Espinosa.
It's Thrive, Don't Only Survive, and a little tagline there, that subtitle, that is, it's Dr. Gio's Guide to Living Your Best Life Before and After Prostate Cancer.
Okay, and there's a very interesting illustration on the cover. And why is it that you chose a walnut to appear on the cover? I think there's sort of a double entendre there, right? Is that walnuts are healthy, but also walnuts signify something else.
Right, right. Well, first of all, Ron, before I answer that question, let me just say that it's a privilege and honor to be on your show. I've been listening to your show for quite a long time, even before I became a doctor, and I still find time to listen in, and I always have takeaways to from the show and those that you interview. So really, thank you so much for having me.
Well, I take it as a real compliment from a very fine health professional. Thank you, Gio. It's nice to hear that.
My pleasure. So why the walnut? Well, you know, in herbal medicine, we learn that in nature, there's the doctrine of signatures, which implies that, you know, depending on how a plant looks or a root or a food, it would signify that it's probably good for a specific body part, that, or at least the shape of that natural product resembles a certain body part. So, for example, when you look at a ginkgo leaf, it looks like a sectional view of the brain with two lobes on the side. And so that, you know, an herbalist would say, well, that's exactly why ginkgo is so good for brain and cognition. A walnut, actually, anytime a urologist or a someone who specializes in men's health, they talk about prostates, you kind of say, well, the prostate is actually shaped like a walnut, and a normal-sized walnut is about the size of a normal-sized prostate. So that's number one. Number two is that there's plenty of literature that walnuts are actually great for prostate cancer, actually. These fatty acids that are found in walnuts, are actually, they show to inhibit inflammation, and inflammatory markers are significant to the development progression of prostate cancer. So that's why the walnut.
Okay. So you talk about, you've coined a term there. You describe the capless method for dealing with prostate cancer. So that's kind of an acronym. Take us through that, please.
Yeah, of course. So I've been working with prostate cancer for about 12 years now, I've been honing and tweaking this program. So I decided to call it something. So we decided to call it the Kaplis method. So Kaplis is an acronym, as you mentioned. Capital C, lowercase a, capital P stands for carcinoma of the prostate. So it's like a medical term for prostate cancer, carcinoma of the prostate. L stands for lifestyle. E stands for exercise and eating. S stands for stress management and sleep, and the other S stands for supplementation. So the Kaplis method is it's a kind of like a prescriptive lifestyle plan for men who are committed to prevent prostate cancer, and those men who have it, whether it's stage one or stage four, is a prescriptive approach where I'm trying to leave no room for confusion and ambiguity. This is what you need to do based on tons and tons of research that I've accumulated and is in the back section of the book. This is exactly what the research says, and this is what you need to do in order to either co-manage your prostate cancer and not die from it, in order for you to live your best life after prostate cancer, and in order for you to prevent prostate cancer.
Okay, so Gio, when we look at cancer, we now pretty much acknowledge that cancer can be prevented via lifestyle, via diet, via exercise, via weight optimization, via avoidance of exposure to harmful chemicals. But when it comes to affecting the course of cancer, that still remains controversial. The notion that you can modify your diet, you can take certain targeted supplements, exercise, that these can actually increase your chances of survival. And even in some cases, we have this thing called active holistic surveillance, where you don't just stand there; you do nothing. You watch the cancer while intervening with these natural approaches. This is the revolution that I think that has occurred in the last few years.
That's right. Well, you know, more and more literature is coming out on lifestyle with regards to active surveillance. So let me just explain what active surveillance is for your listeners, because I've learned a long time ago to take nothing for granted. And,
right.
You know, and to even to the point where a long time ago, very briefly, I taught a class on anatomy physiology. I said, well, I told my students, these were undergrad students, they were ready to become nurses. And I said, well, this is a prostate. And, you know, prostate, when it's enlarged, it causes urinary problems, and these are the urinary symptoms, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the young girls raised her hand and said, doctor, I may have a prostate problem.
Oh, she's led a somewhat sheltered life, I think.
Right. So I've learned a lot. At that point, I learned, well, listen, maybe I should take nothing for granted. So active surveillance in prostate cancer. Well, the main thing that distinction that I make in the book is that active surveillance is not the same thing as watchful waiting. Right. So watchful waiting is a term that's still used sometimes, but hasn't been used since the mid-2000s because it means something different. So watchful waiting means, okay, you have a low-grade cancer or a cancer that should not be treated because it will very likely not kill you. So let's not do anything with it. Let's not do nothing to it. And let's just kind of follow you along until it gets worse. When it gets worse, then we'll just do palliative care. There's no opportunity for cure. With active surveillance, it actually is an opportunity for cure. So you're constantly monitored with PSA and with MRIs and sometimes even with prostate biopsies for X amount of time, depending on the patient's age, where you can still intervene with some sort of aggressive medical treatment with curative intent. So that's the main difference. So there's been studies looking at active surveillance, patients, you know, doing a lifestyle protocol. Dean Ornish, who you know very well, Ron, has, you know, published numerous studies on some sort of lifestyle with active surveillance. Of course, showing that when you do a specific lifestyle, in his case, he did, you know, his experimental group did meditation several times a week. They exercised for 30 minutes a day, six times a week. They ate a plant-based diet. They took a few supplements, vitamin D, vitamin C, fish oils, and things of the sort. And they followed them for 3 months, then 6 months, then a year, then 2 years. After a two-year time period, they showed that a significantly more of those in the control group, which is the group that didn't do the lifestyle, they kind of just came back for a follow-up, they had a significantly more aggressive cancer where that needed to be treated with either radiation or surgery. And a small number of those in the experimental group needed any more aggressive after 2 years. Biochemically, they saw that PSA reduced significantly. Things like LDL cholesterol, which is bad cholesterol, also reduced. Came down as well significantly. And different genetic genetic markers were looked at, telomeres and things like that. So the longer the telomeres, the more likely of you not dying from cancer or even developing cancer. So longer telomeres, which is the end of each chromosome in a DNA, is a good thing. Well, they saw that indeed the group that was doing the lifestyle had much longer telomeres than the group that in a control group. So there is some research indicating that lifestyle, the right lifestyle approach, and in my experience, the Kaplis method, which is a prescriptive lifestyle approach, can indeed have a genetic effect in expressing prostate cancer, and I would argue, you know, most cancers. And so either you keep it quiet and or indolent or silent, like a switch, or you turn it on based on the things that you eat and perhaps things that you are exposed to in your environment.
Right. So there is evidence. And so what are you seeing with your patients? You have patients who maybe are on the borderline where the urologists are not insistent that they have a dangerous form of cancer that needs immediate attention with surgery or radiation, proton beam, what have you. And so these patients are under your care. Do you have long-term survivors of diagnosed prostate cancer using this Kaplis method?
Yeah, so I refined the Kaplis method about 5 years ago, 5-6 years ago, and I've been in practice for about 12 years. So I've had patients for 6 years that are doing extremely well. And so what kind of patients are these? So of course, those that are on active surveillance, for the most part, by and large, have not needed aggressive therapies, because they, particularly those that are most diligent, do not need aggressive therapies. I've even had cases where numerous cases where they're, you know, they initially had a biopsy, which was positive with a, you know, sometimes a lower Gleason 6. And even with some patients with extensive family history, paternal history of prostate cancer, we follow them for 12 months, 16 or 18 months. And they've had a subsequent biopsy subsequent biopsy to determine whether cancer is has come up negative.
Wow, that's impressive.
It is impressive. So while it's been, once again, 6 years is not a long time for following people. With the Kaplis method now, I'm keeping track of more people. And I think as people start buying the book and applying it, they're going to kind of connect with me through the internet, and I'm going to keep track of their data so that we can have more, you know, more objective information, you know, within time. And we can say, well, this works 80%, you know, depending. Interestingly enough, one would ask, well, what happens with people with a recurrence, with prostate cancer recurrence?
Right.
So what is recurrence? A recurrence is where a man develops prostate cancer. They get it treated with either, let's say, external beam radiation, which is radiation, or surgery. They get their prostate removed. And within a certain period of time, they have a PSA recurrence, indicating that the cancers probably have recurred, come back, just returned. That's an interesting scenario because there's really, if the PSA is increasing moderately, I'll give you an example. So the PSA should be zero after a surgery, after a prostatectomy. That's considered undetectable. Well, sometimes it becomes a 0.02, 0.03, then it goes to 0.8, 0.08, then 0.1, 0.2, 0.3. Mm-hmm. So if it keeps increasing in great velocity, then that's very indicative that the cancer is back,
right,
and is back with a vengeance.
Yeah.
Well,
might have spread.
All the time is there treatment, conventional treatment for this particular situation. Sometimes, you know, when the PSA is still very low, hormone therapy or hormone deprivation therapy or radiation is too early. So we've had people on the Kaplis method with a PSA recurrence who are doing remarkable, meaning that their PSA have stabilized. If you need me to, Dr. Hoffman, I can talk a little bit about PSA because it's
sure.
Also a controversial.
Right. There's a lot of people who are hearing the new recommendations from the task force, which state that PSA isn't worthwhile, that men should no longer be screened with a PSA. What's, of course, your take on that?
So the PSA test is clearly very controversial, yes. So you have one group in 2011, the United States Preventative Task Force, that
strongly said we should stop using PSA for the screening of prostate cancer. And you have the urology group saying, hey, we need PSA to screen for prostate cancer because we've saved lives because, you know, due to PSA, so it's very effective. Here's the story, and I don't want to overcomplicate things, because I want to make sure we're as thorough as possible, give a good overview for your listeners. The PSA test is absolutely a very poor marker for prostate cancer in terms of diagnosing prostate cancer. So what has happened in the past is there's been many people diagnosed with low-grade prostate cancer and eventually get treated for prostate cancer. And what the studies show is that they would have never died from their disease, even though they were treated. So that increased significantly the cost of healthcare. So it costs billions of dollars to do biopsies and treatments for prostate cancer, and then treatments for side effects of the treatments for prostate cancer. But the PSA test, there's two valuable aspects to it. Number one is PSA velocity. It does tell you that there's something wrong with the prostate, not necessarily prostate cancer. Unless the PSA is above 20 or so, then there's likely some prostate cancer, some cancer in the prostate if it's above 20. PSA is still very valuable in men with after they've had their prostates treated. So in men after
for monitoring purposes.
Correct, for monitoring purposes. So if there is a PSA and a PSA, what they call PSA recurrence, where there's an increase in PSA after treatment, and that can be significant to prostate cancer. So when you're asking, well, how does the Kaplis method work? It works very effectively, it seems like, in men with a PSA recurrence mm-hmm. situation where the PSA goes up. So what I've seen is men who had their PSA kind of go up even moderately, then the PSA kind of stagnates a little bit once they get to
right.
once they do a protocol like the Kaplis method. And this is men that I've been following in urologists I've followed for maybe 1 or 2 years where there's been a continuous increase in their PSA.
So another way of saying that is that this Kaplis method is effective for prevention. Say you're high risk because of family history or because of a borderline PSA. It's effective once you've been diagnosed with prostate cancer, and perhaps you're even undergoing surgery or radiation therapy, and you want that extra added insurance policy against recurrence, because after all, prostate cancer can recur, depending on the initial severity when you have it. You know, at best, maybe you have a 5% chance. At worst, you may have a 40% chance of recurrence or more. And then you're saying, but even more dramatically, that let's say you're unfortunate and your prostate cancer comes back, PSA starts to rise again. It might have spread. It might be metastatic. You're saying that the Kaplis method can even slow that progression and maybe halt it, correct?
That's exactly what I'm saying. Let's be even a little bit more dramatic. Why not?
Sure.
Men with even men with aggressive prostate cancer. So I've had men who have very aggressive prostate cancer with Gleason 8, 9, and 10.
Right.
Some men with bone metastasis, actually.
Right. So it's out of the box. It's out of the prostate. It's spread to the body. It's in the bone.
That's right. That's right. And there's a large group of men that are doing extremely, extremely well. And when I mean well, I don't mean they're just alive, you know, kind of vegetating in a chair. I mean they're productive. They're feeling great. They're not experiencing pain from bone mets. They're feeling absolutely great. And what I would tell you is, Ron, that there is a correlation between compliance and effectiveness. That doesn't necessarily mean that the patient needs to follow it 100%. But those that follow it more closely definitely tend to do better than those that are loosey goosey with it.
Right. So, hey, if it was just about losing a couple of pounds, looking good at Aunt Sally's wedding, okay, maybe that's a vanity play. But this is a life and death
right.
situation, and for the life of me, I can't understand why. Every man with prostate cancer doesn't undertake such a program. It just totally makes sense.
Well, I'll give you an answer for that.
Yeah.
Men need a diagnosis to take action.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah.
Men don't do much prevention. They need to have a limb almost off before they say, oh, shoot, let me check this out.
Yeah.
It's a psychological thing. There are other things that become priorities. taking care of my family, which is actually of your family, which is very important, and other things, doing well, loving, you know, being productive, being, et cetera, successful, and taking care of their health is not a priority until the diagnosis. This is exactly why I think, Ron, that prostate cancer, a prostate cancer diagnosis is actually an opportunity for men. An opportunity for them to live better. Look, how many times are men? Do I see men coming in here and they have metabolic syndrome, but they come to see me for prostate cancer, and because they get on the capitalist method, they not only not die from prostate cancer, but they don't die from a heart attack, which sometimes they're even more prone to have.
Right.
So
we call
I
this,
think that prostate cancer offers.
We call this an epiphany, you know, like a lightning bolt from above that galvanizes
yeah,
men
right.
towards a healthy lifestyle change, because, you know, that's the way guys are. You know, until something's wrong, a lot of guys don't undertake a preventive approach. That's what I've noticed in 30 years of practice, and I'm sure you've seen that too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep.
All right. So what this, as you might know, because you've done this before, this is actually your frequent contributor to Intelligent Medicine, even before this new book, we divide these podcasts into two parts. So what we're going to do is we're going to go over to part two. And in part two, I want to get specific about the capitalist program. We'll talk supplements. We'll talk about specific diet recommendations. There are some diet controversies surrounding prostate cancer. We'll talk about the exercise connection, maybe a little bit about stress. In part two of today's discussion with Dr. Gio Espinoza. The book is Thrive, Don't Just Survive. Do I have it correct?
Thrive, Don't Only Survive.
Don't Only Survive. All right. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.